Seated. We apologize for keeping you, but the court finished its last case at about 1:10, so it was a rather short lunch break for us, which got extended another 10 minutes. I would like to welcome our class from West Salem High School. Would the students please stand? Thank you. You may be seated. The students are here with a program cleverly entitled Court with Class. It's a national award-winning program. The State Bar of Wisconsin and the Supreme Court have joined together, and we invite students from around the state to come and join us for an oral argument. If the students come, they are sent materials about the case, and they may engage in activities concerning the case. They come, they listen to an oral argument, and in during the lunch hour, they will meet with a student, with a justice who is assigned for that day to meet with the students. And I gather you did meet, and the justices Bradley and Crooks met with you. So we welcome you to this third case this afternoon. If anyone needs a summary of the case, if you'd raise your hand, then we can give you a summary. Anyone need it? All right. Let me introduce the court to you all. On my far left is Justice Michael Gableman. Seated next to him is Justice Patience Robensack. To my immediate left is Justice Patrick Crooks. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley, and to her right, Justice David Prosser, and on the far right, Justice Annette Ziegler. With those introductions made, I'll call our last case for today and for the February calendar, 09AP996-D, Office of Lawyer Regulation versus Alvin Eisenberg. Mr. Richard Kao, Attorney Kao, representing Alvin Eisenberg.
Thank you, Justice Abrahamson. May it please the Court. Richard Kao appears on behalf of Attorney Alvin H. Eisenberg, respondent lawyer in this disciplinary case, and the appellant in this appeal. The storm and the Journal Sentinel notwithstanding, it's a pleasure to be here. And we are appealing from the, and we need relief and ask for a review of the report of the and recommendation of the referee in this case, Dennis Flynn. And what we ask for is a measured look at the conduct involved, a reasonable application of the law, particularly with respect to the difference between mitigation, a lawyer's right to introduce mitigating evidence without being accused of failing to accept responsibility, and a reasonable interpretation of the court's policy of imposing progressive discipline. Lastly, we need to have the court appreciate that there was a very serious factual mistake made by the referee in this matter, which led to some of the conclusions about the only count in this matter that is really of any gravity. The conduct, there's three charges in this case, the first of which is that 12 years ago, Mr. Eisenberg was party to an employment contract with his law firm upon his selling his stock in 1999, which contained a non-compete agreement that restricted him from practice for 6 months after his employment with the firm ceased. And he was represented by counsel in this matter. All the other parties to the contract were lawyers, and notwithstanding, none of them knew that there was a rule in our Wisconsin Supreme Court rule which prohibits lawyers being parties to agreements that have non-compete agreements. That's not offered as an excuse, but it is a reasonable factor to take into account. This is not a very...
Did anybody else who was subject to this agreement get charged with an SCR violation?
18 months after Mr. Eisenberg was charged, Mr. Weigel, the party who benefited from the non-compete agreement, was charged with that.
Were they the only two parties to the agreement?
There were other there was other lawyers party who were not charged. I believe Mr. Blah was a party, and the lawyers involved. Mr. Eisenberg had a lawyer who was not mindful of it.
Thank you.
We filed an answer in this case, which acknowledged that that's a violation of the rule. And we signed a stipulation, which acknowledged that that's a violation of the rule. But it's important to know it was a mistake. I don't think every lawyer in this state appreciates that. Restrictive covenants are not generally unenforceable, even with respect to other licensed professionals. And we also made known to the referee that by the time in 2005, when he was ousted from the firm and the restrictive covenant might have come into play and been of some consequence, he had been advised by me when I learned it that that was an unenforceable provision and it was not honored, it was not enforced. There wasn't a single client deprived of their choice of counsel as a result of it. And while we don't ask that the court absolve Mr. Eisenberg for having signed that agreement, we do ask that they recognize that was done inadvertently, and it was, as these other counts, was both accidental and inconsequential. I ask for a measured look in part because we have this case in a posture unlike most. The complaint in this matter was filed against Mr. Eisenberg by attorney Joseph Weigel, his former partner, the firm of Eisenberg, Weigel, Carl, Carlson, and Blau. I'm getting the names in the wrong sequence, but broke up. And Joe Weigel, who filed the complaint, is the father of one of the constituents of the lawyer discipline system, a very good lawyer. And as a result, the special system was not invoked because that lawyer, Joe Weigel, was not himself a constituent of the system, but a special prosecutor was designated to serve not only as counsel to investigate, but to make the prosecutorial decisions. And while I have great respect for Mr. Schwarzenbart, I would submit that he does not have that seasoned prosecutorial decision-making judgment that the regular staff does. And the ironic result is that in an effort to spare the appearance of some favoritism perhaps being shown to Attorney Weigel on his son's behalf, we were subjected to charges that I promise you the OLR would never have brought in this case. The first of which I've just described. The second two charges.
Let me ask a question, if I may. And that is, you've represented this as inconsequential. And I don't have a retort to that. And I assume you're going to get to the other two counts, which you've said now you've characterized as rather inconsequential. But what makes perhaps these more matters of consequence is not the repeat violations in terms of there are three here, but a prior history. Well, and can a prior history turn something that might not be of the greatest of consequence into something more consequential? And could you address how that fits in, please?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And if a pattern of wrongdoing establishes what the OLR characterizes as one thumbing one's nose at the lawyer discipline system and the Supreme Court rules, absolutely. And the court has, in the past, honored the concept of progressive discipline where that type of pattern is evinced by a lawyer's conduct. In this case, we have a lawyer who was licensed since 1958. Practicing law in this state for 52 years, has two prior counts of misconduct. One was for conduct 30 years ago, for solicitation of a client, in-person recommendation of his help for someone known to be injured. And the second was a private reprimand for conduct 13 years ago for failure to have a proper waiver in a conflict of interest signed and failure to have rules in place in the law firm to better screen for conflicts. That doesn't evince over a 52-year career, that doesn't evince a unwillingness to abide by the rules, I don't think. And moreover, the concept of progressive discipline, the court has never been slavish to that. I mean, witness this lawyer's record as well. I mean, each case has got to rise and fall on its own merits, the first of which was thought to warrant a public reprimand, and the second, a private reprimand.
I'm not sure that progressive discipline necessarily carries with it a component of, well, it looks like they're thumbing their nose at the rules. I don't think that's a necessary ingredient. It is an ingredient in some cases, but I can still see justification for progressive discipline without that ingredient. The fact that a person comes in and had a violation, and of course they have to rise and fall on the individual facts, but there is a certain level of gradation that seems to increase by the number in and of itself.
Sure. All other things being equal, a succession of acts of misconduct probably do warrant the imposition of increasingly severe discipline. But in this case, I can't imagine that the court could come to any conclusion other than that all of the conduct he's accused of was at least accidental and caused no harm. I don't think that if one is subjected to a 6-month suspension for a serious wrongdoing 10 years ago and then commits a very insignificant violation 10 years thereafter, that the court is constrained to impose discipline in excess of 6 months, notwithstanding that the discipline is for conduct that just isn't as aggravated. I
agree with you, and certainly I think the court, at least in part, agrees with you, because look at our decisions, and on occasions that's what's happened. But why not here?
Because, if I may, this conduct is simply not that egregious. It doesn't warrant a public reprimand. The three counts are these. He signed that agreement 12 years ago, didn't know that the rule existed. He circulated, after he was ousted from his firm in 2005, he circulated a targeted direct mail advertisement. It's in our appendix at page 165. It looks like this. And when one submits a targeted direct mail advertisement, a lawyer is obliged to put the word advertisement on it. And the court doesn't need to be reminded of why we have that requirement. And it's because when lawyers were first permitted to circulate targeted direct mail advertisements, they were sending letters to people who were the victims of injuries. And the letters were saying, you should call me and this and that, and your rights need to be protected. And people were being confused into thinking perhaps this lawyer was already involved in their matter, that they were obliged to call them. And so the court instituted a rule saying, if you contact these people, you have to let them know it's an advertisement. Well, Mr. Eisenberg and his former firm, for many years, made use of that as a means of garnering clients. They would find out who was victims of accidents from the DMV reports and send them brochures, send them a brochure like this one. Mr. Eisenberg composed both of them and put the word advertisement on it, on the one that he used for many years. And when he was ousted from his firm and being in a very hurried state, he forgot to put the word advertisement on his brochure, sent it out to people. Now, I have to say, no one's going to mistake this for anything other than an advertisement. So that was, it has to be accepted as a mistake. When it was called to his attention some 10 days later, he changed everything that was lacking. As evidence of the fact that it was done in a hurry, he misspelled the word injuries and made another mistake. In the predecessor brochure, he made mention of the fact that this was Wisconsin's premier personal injury firm since 1958. That was the year he graduated from law school and began practicing. In the new brochure, likewise, he said, Wisconsin's premier injury firm since 1958, Alvin H. Eisenberg, SC. Well, putting SC on it meant, to the OLR's way of thinking, you're mischaracterizing the pedigree of your corporation. Now, I doubt, and that certainly wasn't Mr. Eisenberg's intention. He was trying to tell the recipients of this brochure he's had experience dating back to 1958. And I suspect although there was no evidence from any expert about what this conveyed to the general public, that they weren't interested in how old the corporation was. It was only a few weeks old, and that was a mistake. Once again, something that he admitted. It was an error in this brochure. I don't think the recipients of this brochure cared as much about how old the service corporation was as how much experience has the lawyer who I'm going to have handling my matter. Mr. Eisenberg, and the irony is that the OLR thought that the firm that he sold, which was, by the time he sold it, some 53 employees, the Eisenberg Weigel firm, could still claim to date back to 1958, notwithstanding that nobody there had experience dating back to 1958, and that corporation was formed in 1975. But the OLR justifies Mr. Weigel's conduct by saying, well, they can bootstrap Mr. Eisenberg's prior firms as predecessors to the firm that they bought, and in so doing justifiably claim to date to 1958, but Mr. Eisenberg cannot himself make that claim with respect to his service corporation, notwithstanding that it's his experience that we're talking about. And, you know, what the OLR does or does not do to Mr. Weigel's instances really have no relevance here, but this has to be thought of as, number one, an accident, and number two, of no consequence. The OLR has no grievance in this case except Joe Weigel. No client who says, I was deprived of the right of the client, of the lawyer of my choosing because of the restrictive covenant. No client who says, gee, I thought that was something other than an ad, or some client who said, I was misled and misunderstood, you know, the age of the service corporation and was prompted to some unwarranted action as a result.
Let me be clear. You're not arguing that there is no violation. This case is only an argument on appropriate sanction. Is that correct?
It is. It is. I mean, it can fairly be said. I mean, I said earlier, I don't think the OLR at current administration, with their measured judgment and their sensibilities, would have made these charges. I mean, the lawyers don't get prosecuted. If I make a misstatement of fact here to you today, and I say it's 1958 and it's 1956, well, I'm probably not going to get prosecuted for making a misrepresentation to the court, because everyone might assume it was a mistake. So without trying to say that ignorance of the law is a defense, or that these weren't errors, it's still really relevant to take into account that they were both accidental and inconsequential. The referee in this case made a very serious mistake, a very serious factual mistake. The other respect in which this brochure is criticized is that it does bear some similarity to the brochure used by the firm that Mr. Eisenberg sold. He changed it. He took out the graphics. He took out the taglines. He took out the reference to speaking Spanish and all the things that weren't applicable to his firm. And he gave accurate information about himself. So that if these two brochures were received by their recipients, that is, the accident victims, I don't think there was any. The only danger of confusion was that Mr. Weigel continued to use Mr. Eisenberg's name, even though Mr. Eisenberg said, you may not use that. And the OLR thought nothing and did nothing to prevent him doing that for a period of 2 years. So any confusion that might have been created was by Mr. Weigel's ad. But the mistake that the referee made, and precisely because of that argument that I just made, that Mr. Weigel was behaving badly and Mr. Eisenberg was, as a result, working on a hurried schedule, he thought that Mr. Eisenberg's brochure was sent to the clients of the Eisenberg-Weigel firm in an effort to sort of trick them, perhaps, into thinking that the means by which they could reach their lawyers, who were their lawyers at the time, was to call Mr. Eisenberg. That just comes out of left field. And I fault my own advocacy for setting the groundwork for that misunderstanding. But it was never an allegation. Even Joe Weigel didn't allege this. He didn't allege that these were sent to the client list. Mr. Schwarzenbart didn't allege it in his complaint, and there wasn't a shred of evidence that it was sent to the client list. But the referee concluded that it was. And I don't...
What does that make?
Pardon?
What difference does that make to the violation? The violation is not having the word advertisement on.
Well, that's one violation, but the other and the third and the more serious violation is that it's false, deceptive, and misleading. That it was, and that it was intended to mislead, and that the similarities which it I acknowledge it bears were an effort to mislead. And that is fostered by, and in fact the only, it depends upon this misunderstanding on the part of, Mr. Flynn about the recipients. And although I understand, and, his wrong conclusion, I do ask that the justices ask the OLR for a straight answer about whether or not there was any evidence of that. Because they didn't, Joe Weigel didn't claim it, they didn't put it in their complaint, and there was no evidence of it. And when in our first brief we call upon the OLR to acknowledge that the referee made this mistake, they needn't acknowledge how consequential it was and what may be inferred from it, but to acknowledge that mistake was made, there was a lot of equivocation.
Mr. Kao, to whom was the brochure sent?
It was sent to Mr. Eisenberg would have people examine the records of the Department of Motor Vehicles to see who had been in accidents, check the injury codes and so on, identify people who had been injured in automobile accidents, and send them this brochure. It was not sent to existing clients of the Weigel firm, some 5,000 clients. And part of the source of the referee's confusion was, well, there was some wrangling about clients. I mean, Mr. Weigel said that there was improper contact between Mr. Eisenberg and some people who contacted him after the fact, thinking that he was prohibited contact because of the non-compete agreement, which, notwithstanding having been told it was unenforceable, at least persisted for some period of time in believing that it forbade Mr. Eisenberg competing at all, least of all contacting his clients.
Help me again with the answer to this question. What difference does it make? The charges are, as I understand it, with regard to the mailing, are twofold. There are three charges in total. But with regard to the mailing, it's twofold. Number one, it doesn't have the word advertisement on, and the procedure is that you get it approved before it's sent out.
Right.
And number two, it incorrectly states that this is the premier firm since 1958.
It doesn't have any bearing on that. The rule says put advertisement on it. It didn't say advertisement.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that it will exalt technicality over substance, it could be said that that was false too, the message concerning the genealogy of the firm. But the gravamen of the second count is that it was false, deceptive, misleading, and unfair, that he intended to mislead someone. And that is serious. If he did truly engage in an effort to trick the existing clients of the old firm into hiring him because of the similarities, that is something that's more meaningful. And that didn't happen.
I have an issue in terms of whenever you come here, it's a public reprimand, right? Because
it's publicity.
It's out in the open, it's publicity, right. So what's the point of asking for a private reprimand now?
Well, this is a man who is honorable and who will not willingly suffer that kind of injustice. And so it's anomalous to be in a public forum asking that the court I think the court under these circumstances would have the right to divert if it cared to. You have the
well, the
you haven't done that ever before.
That isn't what the rules say about diversion.
Well, the rules would permit it, in my opinion. I know you've never done it, and I don't expect you to. I mean, these are admitted transgressions, but they just don't warrant a public reprimand. And this lawyer is here at great expense and risking, you know, exposure in excess of that to which he would suffer as a recipient of a public reprimand, because it's not fair. So it is an anomaly, but this court, there is precedent for this court imposing in a public proceeding a private reprimand. It's a little idle with respect to the press and so on, but it's But it nevertheless puts an appropriate decision concerning the culpability and the gravity of the wrongdoing.
Public reprimand would entail a published decision from this court in the Wisconsin reports.
Yes, and it would be published in the Wisconsin Lawyer magazine, and word of it would be circulated to the press, and some is picked up, some is not.
Well, they'd still have to be in order for a private reprimand, since it's here.
Yes, yeah, right. And that's a more measured decision here. The other thing that the referee did that was inappropriate here concerning, he made a mistake concerning the facts that I just described, concerning what happened, and that led him astray. But he also took our introduction of mitigation evidence of the kind I alluded to in these remarks, that he didn't know that the rule provided that there was no restrictive covenants. He overlooked the fact that there wasn't an ad. Not as mitigating factors that he had to honor, and that's okay, because I'll offer mitigating evidence and have it deprecated by this court or by a referee and suffer that. But this referee said, that's aggravating. That's an aggravating factor. And that, I think, was a confusion over our acceptance of responsibility, saying that this referee castigates Mr. Eisenberg, saying, well, he's going to violate the rules again because he thinks that he can do this, or he thinks that ignorance of the law is an excuse. Well, once again, I'm not sure whether this was some failure of advocacy on my part, but I want to make clear, he has admitted these facts and admitted that they constitute violations of the rule. But surely he can say, oh, it was a mistake. I didn't intend to mislead people. I generally include the word ad on my brochures, and I overlooked it. Look, I misspelled injuries. And also to say, I was under the exigent circumstances here made me act hastily. Partly we made a point of telling the referee about the wrongdoing that was being visited upon Mr. Eisenberg by his former partner, and somehow that was taken to mean, well, you know, that if Mr. Weigel was behaving badly, that we had a right to do likewise. It wasn't offered for that. It was offered simply to show that after 52 years of practice, he walked into his office where he had practiced law every day, 7 days a week in an ordinary week, on January 24th, 2005, and found the place gutted. No phones, no furniture, no files, no people. A truck parked outside saying, we've moved. And a letter from his former partner saying, you stay home. And so after all that time, after all that, those years of practice and participating in the construction of this 53-person enterprise, Mr. Eisenberg had to start all over. And he did it in a little hurried way, and he sent out this brochure that had some mistakes in it.
Thank you, Mr. Kao.
Sorry, I had something in front of my red light. Thank you.
You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. W. Schwarzenbart, representing the Office of Lawyer Regulation.
May it please the Court, Your Honors. Paul Schwarzenbart of Madison, Wisconsin, appearing here today as retained counsel and designee of the Office of Lawyer Regulation, the complainant respondent in this attorney discipline case. As the Court is aware, this matter is before it on the appeal of Mr. Eisenberg from the report and recommendation of referee Judge Dennis Flynn. Judge Flynn, in this case, issued a detailed report and recommendation in which he concluded the OLR had satisfied its burden of proof as to each of the three claims for discipline that have been discussed here this morning, or this afternoon, rather, by Mr. Kao. This Court's review, of course, is guided by the standards of review which apply on appeal. There's some things about the review of disciplinary proceedings which are somewhat unique to this context, but basically the referee's findings of fact are are reviewed under the clearly erroneous standard. The referee's conclusions of law, which are the findings or the conclusions that the violations were proven, are reviewed on a de novo basis, and the court independently reviews the recommended discipline. I believe it's clear to the court today that at long last the claims for discipline are not being contested at this time, but rather it's only the recommendation for discipline that's really being challenged on this appeal by Mr. Eisenberg, although I did hear that there's a component of the referee's report that's being characterized as seriously erroneous. Let me start by giving an overview of this case briefly for the court, because essentially I think that one of the arguments that's being advanced here today is that there's a difference in the prosecutorial decision made between myself as the designee of the Office of Lawyer Regulation in this case and what the OLR as an institution would have done. And I know at least in one past instance where I've appeared before the court in a disciplinary proceeding, I was asked questions about the charging decision, and since that decision here was mine as the OLR's designee, I can certainly address that. Mr. Kehoe has described the recommendation of a public reprimand as unfair, and I take issue with that because I believe that in this difficult situation, as the designee of the OLR, I attempted to lean over backward to be fair to both parties involved in this firm breakup dispute. Centrally, what this case involves is disciplinary claims arising out of two very experienced lawyers entering into an agreement which I would characterize as neither fish nor fowl. This agreement, and it's the stock redemption agreement, and the employment contract containing the restrictive covenant is not the type of agreement which really fits into the rules of professional responsibility. Prior to that agreement, Mr. Eisenberg owned a majority of the shares of stock in the law firm of Eisenberg, Weigel, Carlson, Blau, and Clemens, which was a firm he had founded as a sole proprietor in 1958 and turned into a service corporation in 1975 when that became possible under the statutes at that time. In 1990, Mr. Weigel and others joined the firm as minority shareholders. In 1999, the parties entered into this transaction, and as part of that transaction, Mr. Eisenberg did not retire from the practice of law. He entered into an employment contract which provided he was employed as an attorney by the service corporation, although he was no longer a shareholder. His status within the firm was changed to that of an employee or essentially as an associate attorney. But clearly that contract provides that Mr. Eisenberg was to continue to practice law. For reasons which are really not material to the claims here today, Mr. Eisenberg and the firm split up. As the designee of the OLR, because there's another case that will be coming before this court sometime in the future, it's the case against Mr. Weigel, which was alluded to in the argument today, upon reviewing the materials attained in the course of the investigation, on behalf of the OLR, it was my conclusion that the primary grievances that were filed both by Mr. Weigel, primarily initiated by Mr. Weigel, in which he accused Mr. Eisenberg of improper contact with firm clients, that grievance was not sustainable because, in part, this non-compete agreement was not enforceable. What you had was an attorney leaving a firm. Mr. Weigel and his lawyers took the position in the letters, which are part of the stipulation, that they could prevent Mr. Eisenberg from practicing law in Milwaukee and that they had a right to continue to use his name. They filed a lawsuit about that. Based on my own review of the rules of professional responsibility and other materials which are cited in the supplemental appendix to the OLR's brief in this case, the conclusion that I came to is what these lawyers should have done when Mr. Eisenberg's employment was terminated. The employment relationship was terminated is that the two parties should have gotten together and done what the rules contemplate, which is to notify clients of Mr. Eisenberg's departure from the firm and give the clients an opportunity to either stay with the firm or go with Mr. Eisenberg. The firm didn't want to do that because they didn't think Mr. Eisenberg had the right to practice anymore, in part because of this non-compete agreement.
Counselor, what is your strongest argument about why we ought to issue a public reprimand in this case?
My strongest argument, Justice Rogensack, is basically that I think they're outlined in the referee's report. I think Judge Flynn captured the themes of the disciplinary recommendation for the following reasons. Number one, this is the third instance of discipline involving Mr. Eisenberg. And while he may say that's only two times in 50 years, that's two more times than probably 95% of the lawyers who practice in this state. And second, we do believe there is a pattern of misconduct in the sense that the prior instances did involve disputes as to seeking legal business, trying to obtain legal business. And in part, in spite of the fact that Mr. Kao emphasized what appears to be a lapse of time, there is not really a lapse of time. The most recent, it was a private reprimand in 1997, was only a year and a half prior to entering into this stock redemption agreement. And at that time, as part of that agreement, Mr. Eisenberg represented to the OLR that he and the firm would undergo additional training in compliance with the rules of professional responsibility. And therefore, that more recent violation was actually quite close in time to the violation here in 1999 when Mr. Eisenberg signed a non-compete agreement, which is simply flat out prohibited in the state. Now, I think the referee was correct to point out to certain aggravating factors, including the refusal to acknowledge wrongdoing. Mr. Kao says, well, Mr. Eisenberg has always admitted that this was a rule violation. Let me read from the answer, paragraph 42 of Mr. Eisenberg's answer. Admits that he was a signatory to the employment agreement effective March 1, 1999, with the law firm of, and goes on, that included a non-compete covenant as part of the stock redemption agreement providing for sale of his interest in the firm, but denies that this should be considered a violation of SCR 20:5.6 sub A. And he gives a number of reasons why it shouldn't be considered a violation of the rule. Mr. Eisenberg has, throughout this proceeding, stubbornly refused to acknowledge a violation. Yes, he has, and frankly, on behalf of the OLR, I didn't think I was being unfair to either of these parties. The claims that were framed, that were brought to the preliminary review committee and caused to proceed was obtained on the basis of facts which were objective and provable. Both Mr. Weigel, as the majority shareholder acquiring the firm, and Mr. Eisenberg signed the non-compete agreement. They're both responsible for that, so they were both prosecuted for that. The conclusion was neither of them could be prosecuted for improper conduct, contact with clients of the firm, because everyone at that firm had contact with firm clients. They were signed up as members of the firm. Mr. Eisenberg did meet with clients, and it would have been inappropriate for the OLR to say that Mr. Eisenberg would not have had the ability to have any contact with firm clients when he left the firm, when at the same time the firm was continuing to represent those people who may have retained the firm because of Mr. Eisenberg's reputation. We don't know that.
Was there any evidence that Mr. Eisenberg sent the form that said injured and the advertisement? Was there any evidence that he sent that to prior clients of the firm? I just want to know the answer.
But the answer to that is no, there's no evidence of that, and that was not an allegation in the complaint either. And
did
I think
the referee find that?
The referee's findings, I believe, have been mischaracterized, and I would be happy to point to those. This issue is not in any way, shape, or form a linchpin to the claims for discipline on the liability aspect or on what the OLR is asserting justifies.
I don't necessarily disagree with you. I'm just trying to figure out whether you agree that there is no evidence that he sent that to prior clients of the firm.
No, there isn't any evidence. I never said that there wasn't. In fact, the complaint, paragraphs 33 and 34 of the complaint indicate that the form was circulated to the general public for purposes of soliciting legal business. Now, what Referee Flynn stated in his report was that the word this is at page 33, were intended to mislead clients and potential clients to the effect. And at page 35, Referee Flynn says actual or potential clients. So it may be that the referee believed it was sent to both, but we don't believe that that's really essential to either the question of a rule violation or to the discipline.
Okay. And when they file, it's one thing to file an answer and put you to your burden of proof. It's another thing to later stipulate that there's a violation. What happened here?
Justice Ziegler, there never was a stipulation of a violation. And, in fact, if the court reviews the post-trial briefs that were filed in this case, Mr. Kale, I recognize he's got a tough job here, but he attempted to crawl along a very narrow ledge of not technically admitting a violation, but not denying the essential facts that, in our view, prove the violation. I think the argument has been nuanced as the case has gone along to the point where, on review, there is no longer a challenge to the fact of the violations, but there certainly was before the referee. And I think if the court reviews the post-trial briefs, the court will see that at that point, really up through trial, the position that was being taken was that ignorance was a defense in the sense that even if I technically violated the rule, I shouldn't be found to have violated the rule and I shouldn't be punished for it.
Was the stipulation only a stipulation of facts?
It was a stipulation of facts, and that's part of the record. The post-trial argument that was made on behalf of Mr. Eisenberg was that the charges are based upon facts which demonstrate no ethical lapses, only technical and inadvertent violations of rules. No harm was caused. So I think that falls short of a full, honest, and straightforward admission that, yes, I signed an agreement that violated 5.6 sub A. And I think another aggravating factor here again is...
I just want to say, make sure I'm looking at the right thing. I'm looking at the Appendix 108, where the referee, this is in the blue brief, the referee says the stipulation of facts contains the following agreed data regarding the alleged misconduct. That's on 104. And then on 108, the final is a W. In the stipulation, the parties agreed to the truth of the declarations made, but not to their relevancy or probative value, or the extent to which the stipulation conveys a full and accurate portrayal of events relating to the allegations. All of the 15 exhibits referred to are to be admitted in evidence, but there's no stipulation as to the contents, relevancy, or probativeness. Is that what you're relying on?
Yes, sir.
That the stipulation doesn't agree to the allegations in the complaint, that is, doesn't agree that there have been violations, but agrees to these facts?
I think the stipulation speaks for itself, Your Honor, but as the person who initially drafted it, and I believe we actually signed it on the day of the hearing, it was always a stipulation of facts. It was a partial stipulation of facts that covered probably 98% of the facts. But turning again to the issue of what justifies the public reprimand here, I think the continued denial of the second claim for discipline that the advertising flyer, regardless of who it was sent to, was false and misleading and intended to mislead is an aggravating factor, as Judge Flynn noted. The fact of the matter is that the content of the ad is true or false based on what's in the ad. It's the words used in the ad. Mr. Eisenberg is the person who created that advertising flyer, and he is the person who said Wisconsin's premier personal injury firm since 1958. Now we're being told, well, that's just an error, that's an accident. It was Mr. Eisenberg's decision to emphasize the word firm. That's the message that was being sent to the public, to would-be clients, accident victims, whoever else in the public that flyer was sent to. They were being told that this firm is a firm which has been in existence since 1958. Now, combined with the fact that as part of the stipulation, there's an admission that the Eisenberg-Weigel firm, which is now the Weigel firm, also engaged in advertising, I think it's very fair for the referee to have drawn the inference that Mr. Eisenberg was attempting to mislead the public that this firm that he had just formed, Alvin H. Eisenberg SC, was a continuation of the same firm he had founded in 1958, which at one point was built up to 53 employees.
Counsel, you were the special investigator?
Yeah, I was the designee and special investigator in this case pursuant to an appointment by Keith Saline. That appointment occurred about 9 months after the initial grievance was filed.
And were you the one that decided what to seek in terms of discipline?
Yeah, I'm the one who made the decision of what to take to the PRC. And the PRC then issued its decision.
Yes. If there had been no prior discipline as history in this case, do you have an opinion what you would have sought for discipline based on these three violations?
I believe in the absence of prior discipline, I probably would have been speaking with Mr. Kao about seeking a consent private reprimand. But the prior discipline was such, and its relationship here was such, that I didn't believe that that would be appropriate. We had one prior public reprimand and a private just a year and a half before the 1999 violation. And given what was contained in that letter agreement providing for the private reprimand in 1999, it did not seem appropriate to go backward and stay at the private reprimand level for what were a series of violations. And particularly given the content of the advertising and the refusal to admit that the use of the word firm in 1958 was some sort of inconsequential error, that it was not intended to mislead.
So if he would have used attorney, then he'd be all right. But he used the word firm, so that's the violation.
Yes, because it was the word firm was importantly used. I think if one looks at that flyer, the emphasis is put on premier personal injury firm, not premier personal injury lawyer.
It's the second time you've used the word emphasis on the word firm. And I looked at the ad after the first time you said it, and all I see is the word firm. Is there something in my copy that I'm missing? Was there bold or something?
Maybe I'm reading that into it, but you've got Alvin H. Eisenberg SC, which I think even a layperson would understand refers to a service corporation and not a natural person. So
I was just curious, sir, because you used it twice. I wondered what the special emphasis was that you were referring to.
I think it's the combination of the firm and the SC implying the existence of an entity larger than just an individual lawyer.
Did the other firm get charged with these violations for saying they've been around for 58 years when the only person in the firm was no longer there?
The violations against Mr. Weigel for the post-split advertising relate to the continued use of Mr. Eisenberg's name after he had left the firm.
But and it's not that we've been around for 58 years.
No, it relates to the use of Mr. Eisenberg's name, which I think, frankly, is a more serious claim.
There's a little leeway in advertising. Right. A little puffing.
There certainly is, Judge.
And that even goes to lawyer advertising. But misleading or false goes over the line, right?
That's correct, Your Honor. And I think that I didn't, in charging this, we didn't focus so much on the use of the puffing part of the ad, calling it the premier firm, but rather on the firm part and combined with the 1958 part, because as a whole, we would submit that is misleading, given the fact that the firm Mr. Eisenberg had just left was the one that had been around since 1958 and had been built up to 53 employees, and now this one's a brand new firm.
If we have another case that's still pending that deals with how far back you can say you or your firm or whatever goes. And among the misleading and false advertisements, probably, where would you put this on the scale of 1 to 10, 10 being the worst?
This one here?
Yeah.
I would put it probably at toward the middle, toward about a 4 or a 5.
That's where I would put it. So you got an advertisement that doesn't have the words advertisement. It's supposed to have it. It's supposed
right.
to notify the OLR, but they don't approve or disapprove these advertisements. It's just filing with them, really. And I don't even know if they keep it. But anyway, it's just a filing with them. So it doesn't say advertisement. I don't know what else anyone would think about in this. I mean, this is something that you'd find in the Yellow Pages. I don't know if it was, but similar stuff is in the Yellow Pages, right?
Certainly.
When Yellow Pages existed.
I think they're still around in Milwaukee.
So, I mean, that's another issue, but it's hard to say then that this is a major infraction.
The lack of the advertising part? I would agree with that, and if that was the only claim here, certainly it would be diversion agreement stuff.
But that would have been for the OLR to decide, not this
right.
court.
Right.
And so you got the advertisement. He signed an agreement. They all signed an agreement, which they shouldn't have signed at all, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
But restrictive covenants are done all the time for other entities, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Probably done, if not so, what shall I say, blatantly, but done for lawyers leaving firms, too. They're done in terms of don't solicit our old clients, our former clients, or you can only solicit the following clients or things like that, right?
There are different varieties of
different
covenants.
Techniques, not as blatant as this, right?
That's correct.
And there are sales of private practices.
There can be under Supreme Court Rule 20:1.17, and that's why I said at the outset the agreement here is neither fish nor fowl because it doesn't comply with 1.17 either because mm-hmm. Mr. Eisenberg continued to work.
Mm-hmm. I understand that. So you didn't ask for a suspension of any sort?
No, he did not, Your Honor, and I think that's – the decision was – based on trying to balance a number of factors, including the fact that, yes, Mr. Eisenberg, when that firm split up, Mr. Weigel was applying pressure to him, including filing a grievance against him with OLR. So in taking this matter to the PRC, I tried to be cognizant of that pressure and to be fair to Mr. Eisenberg and to take into account that maybe he did things after that firm split up hastily and without giving it enough thought, and maybe somewhat like a bull in a china shop, overreacting to what the former firm was doing to him. And he did not exercise the kind of care and really think about what he should have said in the ad. He may very well have felt I ought to be able to say premier personal injury firm since 1958 because I built that firm, but the fact is he wasn't at that firm anymore, and he should have known better than to try to represent his new firm as a continuation of the one that he had founded and the one he had sold.
Counsel, a moment or two ago, in response to a statement from the Chief Justice, you endorsed the idea that the diversion decision is one exclusively for the OLR. What rule on point? Mr. Kao, a few moments ago, made reference to an interpretation that this court could order a diversion at this point. And I just wonder what rule we're referring to and what language we're talking about.
I had my rule book here. I could tell you that. But
it's in the statutes, yeah. Volume 5. And we'll help you by helping you look it up. Because I'm sure that's not as annotated as your own rule book is.
I believe we're talking about Supreme Court Rule 22.08.
All right, let's just get a chance to look at that. Okay.
22.08 sub 2 sub B is what indicates that one of the options available to the director after a finding of cause to proceed by the PRC is a diversion under 2210.
Yeah, right. And there is the alternative for a diversion.
And it's always been my understanding, and I'll confess that to this one I don't have the institutional knowledge of having served at the office of the OLR for 10 years, but it's always been my understanding that that's a discretionary call delegated to the director rather than one that this court would impose.
It says, at intake, during an investigation, or at the conclusion of an investigation, if the director determines the matter should be diverted to an alternatives to discipline program, the director may offer the opportunity. diversion to an alternatives to discipline program doesn't constitute discipline under the chapter. That's the last sentence. Then the alternatives may include mediation, fee arbitration, et cetera. Then it's eligibility, and that refers to the director, too. And then the agreement is signed between the attorney and the director in sub 4. Costs are on the attorney. Then it has what the effect is, and there's a reference again to the director. And then breach is 7, and that, too, is a reference to what the director does if there is a breach.
You have some high-powered co-counsel.
and then in 2216, what do you think that says? 2116. Justice Bradley calls my attention to 2116. We were just looking at the reference you made. Discipline. Any of the following may be imposed on an attorney. Revocation, suspension, public or private, conditions, monetary payment, restitution, conditions on seeking license. And diversion is not imposed on discipline. It's not a discipline. It's not under 2116, and it's not under 22. So we'd have to read these to say is after you got a complaint about that and a referee finding of misconduct that we could do a diversion, but that would not be a holding of discipline, as I read these.
I wouldn't disagree with that, Your Honor. That's always been my understanding.
Okay. There's some issues about the diversion program, but this is not the time to raise these because diversion is not at issue here as such. Are there any other questions? Justice Prosser.
The $13,190 in costs, that precedes this appeal, or does that include this appeal?
That would, I believe that would, I would have that back at the office. The OLR submits the costs. My recollection is it was approximately half referee and half counsel.
How many days of hearings were there?
This was a one-day hearing.
These are fairly substantial costs, are they not?
I don't believe so. I think the referee, it's unusual that the referee costs would be roughly equal to counsel costs. That's the one observation I would agree with. I think the referee spent a lot of time preparing the report.
The statement of costs that we have in front of us is dated 2nd of September 2010.
That would be pre-appeal or pre-appellate brief.
So we're talking ballpark figure?
Probably another 3,000 to 5,000. There are no further questions. My red light is on. Thank you, Your Honor.
Did the referee make any recommendations as to cost?
The referee recommended payment of full cost.
Thank you, counsel. Gayo, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Any comment on costs?
Mr. Schwarzenbart started and ended his argument saying that he bent over backwards to not to be unfair and to be fair to these parties, and I have no doubt that he tried, but he failed. This prosecution is not fair. The rules with respect to targeted direct mail advertisement require that lawyers who send these things out, file them within 5 days with the OLR. They don't do that so that the OLR can pounce on them with respect to shortcomings in what they do. They send them, and the OLR makes a practice of saying, well, you didn't put the word advertisement on, or the type is too small, or it's not on the envelope. There's a lot of technical rules. There has never once been a prosecution of a lawyer for making a little mistake like this with respect to a targeted direct mail advertisement. And Mr. Eisenberg shouldn't be made the subject of it simply because the grievant against him is the father of one of the constituents of the system. Now, I'm not trying to draw any sort of sinister plot here, but the ironies are just terrible. And it's why I do walk out.
Especially since the father is up on his own problems.
Right. I mean, he's up on his own problems, except with respect to his entitlement, apparently, to in advertising a service corporation that dates back to 1975, he's entitled to say it goes back to 1958, to Mr. Eisenberg's graduation date, even though Mr. Eisenberg himself is not permitted to do that. That's unfair. I mean, I'm sorry. That is not equal application of the law.
Mr. Cale, perhaps you, first of all, I have two questions. The first, I heard Justice Prosser, as you approached the podium, he asked, first, do you have any comment on the issue of costs? And then after that, I would like you to address, from what I took from Mr. Schwarzenbart's comment, it's not necessarily that your client is stipulating to the fact of a violation. And if that's so, is there any reason why you're not asking this court for a dismissal?
Thank you. Now, please don't impose costs. This has been terribly burdensome for Mr. Eisenberg under circumstances that don't warrant the charges and the litigation, or at least of all the expense or a public reprimand.
I have a little problem in listening to the comments, because it sounds to me that you're preciously close to saying there's no violation. And that's why I asked initially. Now, the only thing that's in contention here, right, is the level of discipline. And then you said yes.
Yes.
The argument, as I heard it, at least in part, had flavor of no violation. And yet you contested violation all the way through the hearing. Am I correct
incorrect? No. He was a signatory to a restrictive covenant, and mistakenly so, but nevertheless, that violates the rule. As the Chief Justice observed, however, the state is rife with these types of agreements, and more subtle ones, where, for example, if you retire and if you assume the bench, you'll get certain payout from our firm. If you set up in a competition to us, you get significantly less.
Some of that goes, in my mind, to level of discipline. What I'm trying to pin down, and I think the answer is, that you contested violations at the hearing.
No.
Okay.
These are violations. And I will say, you know, he was mistaken about describing the SC. If you take it to mean an intent to describe the SC as dating to 58, that's not correct. Didn't have the word advertisement, and he signed the agreement. Those are all violations. But these rules are not self-enforcing. I mean, with prosecutorial discretion distinguishes between simple mistakes.
So now we have, was there a violation? Should it be prosecuted? And if there's a violation, it should be prosecuted. What's the level of discipline? So I hear it going back and forth. We're addressing in part the issue of costs. It makes a difference to me whether or not someone comes in to the court complaining about costs after they fought it tooth and nail, or if they come into court complaining about costs if they stipulated to a violation and we're only talking about the level of discipline. Show me where there was an admission of violation or a stipulation or something that would clear this up for me, whether or not you contested violation at the before the referendum.
Right. If I may, right from the start, we admitted all of the facts underlying this, but we did say in the exercise of prosecutorial discretion, these could have been diverted. And incidentally, I think SCR 20.1.16, which says this court, these are things the court may do. The court does not sacrifice the ability to divert. I mean, you've established a diversion program, and you didn't relinquish the authority to do that. And it specifically says you can impose conditions on the continued practice of law. Diversion agreements typically say, well, you didn't set your ad up very well. We want you to take some more CLE, in particular on lawyer advertising. This court could do that and say,
What's the answer to my question? My question is, did you contest a violation at the hearing or did you not contest a violation at the hearing? Was that contested?
No. I think that we admitted the violations, but said that they were inadvertent and shouldn't be the subject of certainly not a public reprimand.
And can you point to where that admission exists? And I'm happy to find it and happy to see it. I just think that that needs clearing up in my mind. Because
I think that we did that in our post-hearing briefing. I think I did that in the opening statement at the hearing to say these, as I am now, he signed an agreement. It violates the rule. The rule says, and so that's a violation.
That is clear to me now, pretty clear to me now, that you are admitting violation and we are here on sanction only. And that's clear to me, although it wasn't earlier. But it's clear to me because I asked that question directly of you and you responded, we are here only on the level of sanction. Okay, so that's clear to me. What isn't clear to me is what was done before the referee. Now, you've said you've admitted it in post-hearing briefing. Not quite good enough, because that means you went through all the hearing. Now you're saying you also admitted it in opening statement. So if I look to your opening statement, assuming it's transcribed, I'm going to find your admission for violation. Is that what's happening?
I believe so. And I have, as Mr. Schwarzenbart pointed out, been walking a line saying, yes, he did these things, and the rule requires that you're not false, deceptive, misleading, or unfair, and this is a mistake. But it's a violation. But it's not the kind of violation which is prosecuted ever under other circumstances. Did I answer your question,
no,
Justice Gableman?
No, I wasn't going to let you leave the podium without it either.
Yes, I'm sorry.
No, not at all. It wasn't your fault. That goes
mea
to the
culpa,
reason.
Mea culpa, mea maxima culpa.
And that, the response to the colloquy you just had with Justice Bradley, I guess points out the, it was a narrow ledge referred to by Mr. Schwarzenbart, and, but that there's an admission of conduct which would constitute a violation. And so that is why you're not here asking for a dismissal. Is that right?
Right. I have not asked for a dismissal. And I don't. But I think that the court, if the court properly evaluates this, they'll do something less than the public reprimand. And if I may, the referee does say on page 17 of his report, after respondent's termination with the firm, Attorney Eisenberg did contact those persons he believed were his clients through his targeted advertising brochure or flyer. That wasn't alluded to in Mr. Schwarzenbart's remarks, and that really makes clear that the referee was mistaken in that respect. And that's where all the sinister inferences about his motivations stem from. I see my red light on. Thank you.
Any other comments, Mr. Cale?
I do.
Very short, please.
Mr. Schwarzenbart said that the restrictive covenants are flat out impermissible. And he cites in his brief Williston on contracts, but Williston on contracts itself says, as we point out in our brief, that most lawyers don't know this. I can't be up here saying ignorance of the law is a defense, but it's certainly relevant.
What do you think the purpose of that rule is?
Who's
it protect?
The purpose, clients. The purpose is to prevent clients being prohibited getting the lawyer of their choosing. I think very often it's to prevent defendants, like in a products liability case, for saying, all right, we'll pay you your $10 million, but you're going to agree never to take a case against us again. And law firms from prohibiting their clients from having the lawyer they want to have represent them. And in this case, not one single client was deprived of the right to have Mr. Eisenberg's services because that restrictive covenant, by the time it became relevant, was known to be unenforceable. And so it was never enforced. It was never honored. And so it can fairly be said it wasn't of any consequence. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Cale. Thank you, Mr. Schwarzenbart. As you both know, having appeared previously in OLR cases, these are very difficult for OLR. They're very difficult for the individual lawyer who is being charged with a violation and difficult for the court. That concludes our argument in 09AP996-D, Office of Lawyer Regulation versus Alvin H. Eisenberg. The court is adjourned for oral arguments in February, but has many closed conferences as well as an open conference tomorrow. The court will meet in the conference room and closed conference at, is it 5:03? 25 after 3. We are adjourned.